axes in the pockets. Of course not, we're not stupid. Hey, come on now, kindly don't mess with our things, said Jean. As if by some unspoken signal, he and Locke reached out to brace themselves against the cliff, finding hand and footholds as quickly as they could.
Why not? They're such fine things, sirs. I just can't help but feel sort of drawn to them, like.
If you'll just wait right there, said Locke, preparing to begin climbing, one of us should be up in a few minutes, and I'm sure we can discuss this civilly.
I'm also sort of drawn to the idea of keeping you two down there, if it's all the same to you, gents.
The man moved slightly, and a hatchet appeared in his right hand.
It's a mighty fine pair of choppers you've left up here with your coats, too. Damned fine. Ain't never seen the like.
That's very polite of you to say, yelled Locke.
Oh, sweet jumping fuck, muttered Jean.
I might point out, however, continued Locke, that our man at the carriage is due to check on us soon, and he'll have his crossbow with him.
Oh, you mean the unconscious fellow I like jacked over the head with a rock, sir? Sorry to report that he was drunk.
I don't believe you. We didn't give him that much beer.
Begging pardon, but he weren't all that much man, gents. Skinny fellow, if you savvy. As it is, he's sleeping now. And he didn't have no crossbow anyway. I checked.
Well, I hope you don't blame us for trying, said Locke.
I don't, not one little bit. Good try, very creditable-like. But I'm sort of interested, if you don't mind, in the whereabouts of your purses.
Safely down here with us, said Locke. We might be convinced to surrender them, but you'll have to help haul us up if you want them.
Now, on that subject, said the stranger, you and I have a sort of difference in outlook, like. Since I know you've got 'em now, I think it's easier to just chop you down and collect 'em at my ease.
Unless you're a much better rock climber than you look, said Jean. It's one hell of a climb down and back for the sake of our little purses. And they are little, said Locke. Our rock-climbing purses, specially made not to weigh us down, hardly held anything.
I think we probably got different ideas of what anything is, and I wouldn't have to climb, said the stranger. There's easier ways down to that valley floor if you know where to go.
Don't be foolish, said Jean. These ropes are demi-silk. It'll take you some time to cut through them. Longer than it will take for us to climb back up, surely.
Probably, said the man in the cloak. But I'm still up here if you do, ain't I? I can just crack you over the edge and make your skulls into soup bowls, like. See if I don't.
But if we stay down here, we'll die anyway. So we might as well come up and die fighting, said Locke.
Well, have it your way, sir. Whole conversation's getting sort of circular, if you don't mind me saying so. So I'm just going to start cutting rope now. Me, I'd stay put and go quiet, was I you.
Yeah, well, you're a miserable cur, shouted Locke. Any child of three could murder helpless men hanging over a cliff. Time was when a bandit would have the balls to fight us face to face and earn his pay.
What do I rightly look like, sir? An honest tradesman? Guild tats on my arms?
He knelt down and began to chop at something steadily with Jean's hatchet.
Splatting you against those rocks below seems a fine way of earning my pay. Even finer, if you're gonna speak so unkind.
You're a wretch, cried Locke. A cringing dog, a scrub, damned not just for avarice but for cowardice. The gods spit on those without honour, you know. It'll be a cold hell and a dark one for you.
I'm chock full of honour, sir. Got lots of it. Keep it right here between my empty stomach and my puckered white ass, which you may kiss, by the way.
Fine, fine, said Locke. I merely wanted to see if you could be goaded to misjudgment. I applaud your restraint, but surely there's more profit to be had in hoisting us up and holding us for ransom.
We're important people, said Jean. With rich, important friends. Why not just hold us prisoner and send a letter with a ransom demand?
Well, said the man, for one thing, I can't read nor write.
We'd be happy to write the demand for you.
Can't rightly see how that'd work. You could just write anything you like, couldn't you? Ask for constables and soldiers instead of gold, if you take my meaning. I said I can't read, not that I got worm piss for brains.
Whoa, hold it, stop cutting.
Jean heaved himself up another foot and braced his rope within the descender to hold him.
Stop cutting, I have a serious question.
What's that then?
Where the hell did you come from?
Roundabouts, here and there, by way of my mother's womb, original-like, said the man, who continued chopping.
No, I mean, do you always watch these cliffs for climbers? Seems bloody unlikely they'd be common enough to skulk in ambush for.
Oh, they isn't, sir. Ain't never seen any before you two. Was so curious I just had to come down and take a peek. And ain't I glad I did?
Chop, chop, chop.
No, mostly I hide in the woods. Sometimes the hills. Watch the roads.
All by yourself?
I'd be cutting you down faster if I wasn't by myself, wouldn't I?
So you watch the roads, looking to rob what, carriages?
Mostly.
You have a bow or a crossbow?
Sadly, no. Think maybe I might buy a piece if I can get enough for your things.
You hide in the woods, all by yourself, and try to ambush carriages without a real weapon?
Well, said the man a bit hesitantly, has been a while since I got one, but today's my lucky day, ain't it?
I should say so. Crooked Warden, you must be the worst highwayman under the sun.
What did you say?
He said, said Locke, that in his highly educated opinion, you're the...
No, the other part.
He mentioned the Crooked Warden, said Locke. Does that mean something to you? We're members of the same fraternity, friend. The Benefactor, the Thief Watcher, the Nameless 13th, patron of you and I and all who take the twisty path through life. We're actually consecrated servants of the Crooked Warden. There's no need for animosity and no need for you to cut us down.
Oh, yes, there is, said the man vehemently. Now I'm definitely cutting you down.
What? Why?
Bloody fucking heretics, you are. There ain't no 13th. Ain't naught but the 12, that's truth. Yeah, I been to Vera a couple times, met up with lads and lassies from the cutting crews what tried to tell me about this 13th. I don't hold with it. Ain't right like I was raised. So down you go, boys.
The man began hacking at the demi-silk ropes with a vengeance.
Shit. Want to try and snag him in the belay lines?
Jean swung over beside Locke and spoke with soft urgency. Locke nodded. The two thieves took hold of their ends of their belay lines, stared upward, and at Jean's whispered signal, yanked them downward. It was hardly an efficient trap. The lines were slack and coiled up above the cliffs. Their tormentor looked down at his feet, hopped up and stepped away as 7 or 8 feet of each belay line slipped over the cliff's edge.
Ha! You'll have to get up earlier than that, gents, if you don't mind my saying so.
Whistling tunelessly, he vanished out of sight and continued chopping. A moment later he gave a cry of triumph, and Locke's coiled belay line flew over the edge of the cliff. Locke averted his face as the rope fell just past him. It was soon dangling in thin air from his waist belt, its frayed far end still too many feet above the ground for safety.
"Shit!" said Locke. "Right, Jean, here's what we do. He should cut my main line next. Let's hook arms. I'll slide down your main line, not what's left of mine, to the bottom, and that should probably get us within 20 feet or so of the ground. If I haul up my belay line and knock that on the end of the other two, we can make it all the way down."
"Depends on how quickly that asshole cuts. You think you can tie knots fast enough?"
"I think I've got no choice. My hands feel up to the task, at least. Even if I just get one line lashed, 20 feet's a happier fall than 80.
At that moment, there was a faint rumble of thunder overhead. Locke and Jean looked up at just the right moment to feel the first few drops of rain on their faces.
"It's possible," said Locke, "that this would be really fucking amusing right now, were it anyone but us down on these ropes."
"At the moment, I think I'd take my chances with your pigeons if I could," said Jean. "Damn, I'm sorry for leaving the wicked sisters up there, Locke."
"Why in Venaportha's name would you have brought them down? There's nothing to apologize for."
"Although," said Jean, "maybe there is one other thing I could try. You carrying sleeve steel?"
"Yeah, but it's in my boot."
The rain was beating down fairly hard now, soaking through their tunics and wetting their lines. Their light dress and the stiff breeze made it seem colder than it really was.
"Yourself?" "Got mine right here."
Locke saw a flash of bright metal in Jean's right hand.
"Yours balanced for throwing, Locke?"
"Shit, no. Sorry."
"No worries. Hold it in reserve, then. And give us a good silent prayer."
Jean paused to pluck off his optics and tuck them into his tunic collar, then raised his voice.
"Hey, sheep lover! A word, if you please!"
"I sort of thought we was done talking,"
came the man's voice from above the cliff's edge.
"No doubt. I'll wager using so many words in so short a time makes your brain feel like a squeezed lemon, doesn't it? You wouldn't have the wit to find the fucking ground if I threw you out of a bloody window. Are you listening? You'd have to take your shoes and breeches off to count to 21. You'd have to look up to see the underside of cockroach shit. Does it help, yelling at me like that? Seems like you should be praying to your useless 13th or something. But what would I know? I ain't one of you big-time Ferrari felon tossers or whatever, am I?
You want to know why you shouldn't kill us? You want to know why you shouldn't let us hit that valley floor?"
Jean hollered at the top of his lungs while bracing his feet more firmly against the cliffside and pulling back his right arm. Thunder echoed overhead.
"See this, you idiot? See what I've got in my hands? Something you'll see only once in a lifetime. Something you'll never forget."
A few seconds later, the man's head and torso appeared over the edge of the cliff. Jean let out a cry as he flung his knife with all of his strength. The cry became triumphant as he saw the blurred shape of his weapon strike home in their tormentor's face, and changed yet again to a frustrated groan as he saw the knife bounce back and fall away into thin air. It had struck hilt first.
"Fucking rain!" yelled Jean.
The bandit was in serious pain, at least. He moaned and clutched his face, teetering forward. A nice hard smack in the eye? Jean fervently hoped so. Perhaps he still had a few seconds to try again.
"Locke, your knife, quickly!"
Locke was reaching into his right boot when the man thrust his arms out for balance, lost it, and toppled screaming over the edge of the cliff. He got one hand around Locke's main line a second later and fell directly into the crook of Locke's waist and rope, where they met at the iron descender on his belt. The shock knocked Locke's legs away from the cliff as it knocked the breath from his lungs, and for a second he and the bandit were in free fall, flailing and screaming in a tangle of arms and legs, with no proper pressure on the line in the descender. Straining himself to the utmost, Locke curled his left hand around the free side of the line and tugged hard, putting enough strain on the rope to snap them to a halt. They swung into the cliff face together, the bandit taking the brunt of the impact, and dangled there in a struggling mess of limbs while Locke fought to breathe and make sense of the world. The bandit kicked and screamed.
"Stop that, you fucking moron!"
They seemed to have fallen about 15 feet. Jean slipped rapidly down beside them, alighted on the cliff, and reached out with one hand to grab the bandit by the hair. With the hood thrown back, Locke could see that the fellow was grizzled, like an underfed hound, perhaps 40, with long, greasy hair and a grey beard as scrubby as the grass on the cliff's edge. His left eye was swelling shut.
"Stop kicking, you idiot! Hold still!" "Oh, gods, please don't drop me! Please don't kill me, sir!"
"Why the fuck not?"
Locke groaned, dug his heels into the cliff, and managed to reach the edge of his right boot with his right hand. A moment later, he had his stiletto out at the bandit's throat, and the man's panicked kicking became a terrified quivering.
"See this?" Locke hissed. The bandit nodded. "This is a knife. They have these wherever the fuck you came from?"
The man nodded again.
"So you know I could just stick you right now and let you fall, right?" "Please, please don't!" "Shut up and listen. This single line that you and I are dangling from right now, single, solitary, alone, this wouldn't be the line you were just chopping at up there, would it?"
The man nodded vigorously, his good eye wide.
"Isn't that splendid? Well, if the shock of your fall didn't break it, we're probably safe for a little while longer."
White light flashed somewhere above them and thunder rolled, louder than before.
"Though I have been much more comfortable. So don't kick, don't flail, don't struggle, and don't do anything fucking stupid, savvy?" "Oh, no, sir. Oh, please." "Shut up already."
Leocanto, said Jean, "I'm thinking this fellow deserves some flying lessons."
"I'm thinking the same thing," said Locke. "But thieves prosper, right, Jerome? Help me haul this stupid bastard back up there somehow." "Oh, thank you, thank—"
"Know why I'm doing this, you witless woodland clown?"
"No, but I—"
"Shut it. What's your name?"
"Trav."
"Trav what?"
"Never had no afternamed, sir. Trav of Vosarmara is all."
"And you're a thief? A highwayman?"
"Yes, yes, I am."
"Nothing else? Do any honest work?"
No, not for some time now."
"Good. Then we are brothers of a sort. Look, my smelly friend, the thing you have to understand is that there is a 13th. He does have a priesthood, and I'm one of his priests, savvy?"
"If you say so."
"No, shut up. I don't want you to agree with me. I want you to use your misplaced acorn of a brain before the squirrel comes looking for it again. I have a blade at your throat. We're 70 feet above the ground, it's pissing a nice hard rain, and you just tried to murder me. By all rights, I ought to give you a red smile from ear to ear and let you drop. Would you agree to that?"
"Oh, probably, sir. Gods, I'm sorry."
"Hush now, sweet moron. So you'd admit that I must have a pretty powerful reason for not satisfying myself with your death?"
I guess.
"I'm a divine of the Crooked Warden, like I said, sworn to the service and the mandates of the god of our kind. Seems kind of a waste to spit in the face of the god that looks out for you and yours, doesn't it? Especially since I'm not so sure I've been doing right by him recently."
I should kill you. Instead, I'm going to try and save your life.
All I want you to do is think about this. Do I still seem like a heretic to you?
Oh, God, sir, I can't think straight.
Well, nothing unusual there, I'd wager. Remember what I said. Don't flail, don't kick, don't scream. And if you try to fight, even the tiniest bit, our arrangement's off. Wrap your arms around my chest and shut up. We're a good long way from sitting pretty. 2. At Locke's urging, Jean went up first, hand over hand on the slick cliff face at about half his usual speed. Up top, he rapidly unknotted his own belay line from his belt and passed it down to Locke and his shaken passenger. Next, he took his harness off and slid his main line along the cliff edge until it too was beside the dangling men. They certainly didn't look comfortable, but with all three good lines in their reach, they were at least a bit safer. Jean found his frock coat on the ground and threw it on, grateful for the added coverage even if it was as sopping wet as the rest of him was. He thought quickly. Trav seemed a fairly meatless fellow, and Locke was lightly built. Surely they were no more than 300 pounds together. Jean was sure he could hoist nearly as much to his chest, perhaps even above his head. But in the rain, with so much at stake? His thoughts turned to the carriage, about a quarter mile distant through the woods. A horse would be a vast improvement on even a strong man, but the time it would require, and the trouble inherent in unhooking, calming, and leading a beast whose master had been clubbed unconscious... "Fuck it," he said, and went back to the cliff's edge. "Leocanto! Still here, as you might have guessed. Can the two of you make one of my ropes good and fast to your belt?" There was a brief muttered conversation between Locke and Trav. "We'll manage," Locke yelled. "What do you have in mind?" "Have the idiot hold tight to you. Brace your arms and legs against the cliff once you've lashed yourselves to one of my lines. I'll start hauling on it with all I've got, but I'm sure your assistance won't hurt." "Right. You heard the man, Trav. Let's tie a knot. Mind where you put your hands." When Locke looked up and gave Jean their private hand signal for proceed, Jean nodded. The secured rope was Jean's former belay line. He seized the working end just before the coil that lay on the wet ground and frowned. The sludge underfoot would make things even more interesting than they already were, but there was nothing else for it. He formed a bite in the rope, stepped into it, and let it slide tight around his waist. He then leaned back, away from the cliff, with one hand on the rope before him and one hand behind, and cleared his throat. "Tired of dangling? Or shall I let you have a few more minutes down there?" "Jerome, if I have to cradle Trav here for 1 second longer than I absolutely must, I'm going to..." "Climb away, then." Jean dug his heels in, allowed himself to lean even farther back, and began to strain at the rope. Gods damn it, he was a powerful man, unusually strong, but why did moments always come along to remind him that he could be even stronger? He'd been slacking, no other word for it. He should find some crates, fill them with rocks, and heave them up a few dozen times a day, as he had in his youth. Damn, would the rope ever move? There. At last, after a long, uncomfortable interval of motionless heaving in the rain, Jean took a slow step back, and then another, and another. Haltingly, with an itching fire steadily rising in the muscles of his thighs, he did his best impression of a plough horse, pushing deep furrows into the gritty grey mud. Finally, a pair of hands appeared at the edge of the cliff, and in a torrent of shouts and curses, Trav hoisted himself up over the top and rolled onto his back, gasping. Immediately the strain on Jean slackened. He maintained his previous level of effort, and just a moment later Locke popped over the edge. He crawled to his feet, stepped over beside Trav, and kicked the would-be bandit in the stomach.
"You fucking jackass! Of all the stupid damn... How difficult would it have been to say, I'll lower a rope, tie your purses onto it and send them up, or I won't let you back up. You don't tell your bloody victims you're just going to kill them outright. You come on reasonable first, and when you have the money, you run.
Oh.
Ow! Gods, please! Ow! You said you wouldn't kill me!
And I meant it. I'm not going to kill you, you cabbage-brained twit. I'm just going to kick you until it stops feeling good.
Ow! Gah! Please! Ow!
I have to say, it's still pretty fascinating.
Aya! Ow!
Still enjoying myself.
Oof! Ah!
Locke finally ceased pummeling the unfortunate Ferrari, unbuckled his harness belt, and dropped it in the mud. Jean, breathing heavily, came up beside him and handed him his soaked coat.
Thank you, Jerome. Having his coat back, sopping or no, seemed to salve some of Locke's wounded dignity.
As for you, Trav? Travavo Salmara, you said? Yes! Oh, please, don't kick me again!
Look here, Trav. Here's what you're going to do. First, tell no one about this. Second, don't fucking go anywhere near Tal Verar. Got it?
Wasn't planning to, sir.
Good. Here.
Locke reached down into his left boot and drew out a very slender purse. He tossed it down beside Trav, where it landed with a jingling plop.
Should be 10 Valani in there. A healthy bit of silver. And you can...
Wait a minute. Are you absolutely sure our driver's still alive?
Oh, gods, yes. Honest truth, Master Leo Canto, sir. He was breathing and moaning after I thumped him. He surely was.
So much the better for you, then. You can have the silver in that purse. When Jerome and I have left, you can come back and take whatever we leave. My vest and some of this rope, for sure. And listen to me very carefully. I saved your life today when I could have killed you in a heartbeat. Sound about right to you?
Yes, yes you did, and I'm so very...
Yes, shut up. Some day, Trav of Vo Sarmara, I may find myself back in these parts, and I may need something. Information, a guide, a bodyguard. 13 help me if it's you I have to turn to, but if anyone ever comes to you and whispers the name of Leocanto Costa, you jump at their word. You hear?
Yes.
Your oath before the gods?
Upon my lips and upon my heart, before the gods, or strike me dead and find me wanton on the scales of the Lady of the Long Silence.
Good enough. Remember... Now fuck off in the direction of your choice, so long as it isn't back toward our carriage.
Jean and Locke watched him scamper away for a minute or two, until his cloaked figure had faded from view behind the shifting grey curtains of the downpour.
Well, said Jean, I think that's enough practice for one day, don't you?
Absolutely. The actual Sinspire job will be a bloody ballroom dance compared to this. What say we just grab the 2 spare coils of rope and make for the carriage? Let Trav spend the rest of the afternoon out here untying knots.
A lovely plan.
Jean inspected his wicked sisters, recovered from the edge of the cliff, and gave them a possessive pat on their blades before slipping them into his coat pocket.
There, darlings. That ass might have dulled you a bit, but I'll soon have you sharpened up again.
"I hardly credit it," said Locke. "Nearly murdered by some half-wit country mudsucker. You know, I do believe that's the first time since Velvirazzo that anyone's actually tried to kill either of us."
"Seems about right. 18 months."
Jean slipped one wet coil of rope around his shoulder and passed the other to Locke. Together they turned and began to trudge back through the forest.
Nice to know that some things never really change, isn't it?
Chapter 6 Balance of Trades 1 Whoever put those assassins there obviously knew we used that path to get back to the Savrola, said Locke.
Which doesn't mean all that much. We've used the docks often. Anyone could have seen us and set them there to wait.
Jean sipped his coffee and ran one hand idly over the battered leather cover of the small book he'd brought to breakfast.
Maybe for several nights. It wouldn't require any special knowledge or resources.
The gilded cloister was even quieter than usual at the seventh hour of the morning this Thrones Day. Most of the revellers and business folk who provided its custom would have been up late on the golden steps and would not rise for several hours. By unspoken consent, Locke and Jean's breakfast this morning was designed for nervous nibbling, cold fillets of pickled shark meat with lemon, black bread and butter, some sort of brownish fish broiled in orange juice, and coffee, the largest ceramic pot the waiter could find to bring to the table. Both thieves were still having trouble adjusting to the sudden turnaround in their nights and days.
"Unless the bonds mage I tipped another party off to our presence here in Tal Vahrar," said Locke, "they might even be helping them."
"If the bonds magi had been helping those two on the docks, do you really think we'd have survived? Come on. Both of us knew they were probably going to come after us for what we did to the Falconer, and if they just wanted us dead, we'd be smoked meat. Stragos is right about one thing. They must mean to toy with us. So I still say it's more likely that some third party took offense at something we've done as Costa and De Ferra. That makes Durenna, Corvalur, and Lord Landreval the obvious suspects. Landreval's been gone for months. That doesn't rule him out completely. The lovely ladies, then.
I honestly believe they'd come after us themselves. Durenna has a reputation with a sword, and I hear that Corvalur's been in a few duels. Maybe they'd hire some help, but they're hands-on sorts.
Did we bilk anyone important at Blind Alliances? Or some other game when we were playing our way up through the floors? Step on someone's toe? Fart noisily?
I can't imagine that we'd have missed someone disgruntled enough to hire assassins. Nobody likes to lose at cards, to be sure. But do any really sore losers stick out in memory?
Jean scowled and sipped his coffee. Until we know more, this speculation is useless. Everyone in the city is a suspect. Hell, everyone in the world.
So in truth, said Locke, all we really know is that whoever it is wanted us dead. Not scared off, not brought in for a little chat, plain old dead. Maybe if we can ponder that, we might come up with a few...
Locke stopped speaking the instant he saw their waitress approaching their booth, then looked more closely and saw that it wasn't their waitress at all. The woman wearing the leather apron and red cap was Merain.
"Ah," said Jean, "time to settle the bill."
Merain nodded and handed Locke a wooden tablet with two small pieces of paper pinned to it. One was indeed the bill. The other had a single line written on it in flowing script. "Remember the first place I took you the night we met? Don't waste time."
"Well," said Locke, passing the note to Jean, "we'd love to stay, but the quality of the service has sharply declined. Don't expect a gratuity."
He counted copper coins onto the wooden tablet, then stood up.
"Same old place as usual, Jerome."
Merain collected the wooden tablet and the money, bowed, and vanished in the direction of the kitchens.
"I hope she doesn't take offense about the tip," said Jean when they were out on the street.
Locke glanced around in every direction and noticed that Jean was doing likewise. Locke's sleeve stilettos were a comforting weight inside each arm of his coat, and he had no doubt that Jean was ready to produce the Wicked Sisters with a twitch of his wrists.
"Gods!" Locke muttered. "We should be back in our beds, sleeping the day away. Have we ever been less in control of our lives than we are at this moment? We can't run away from the Archon and his poison, which means we can't just disengage from the Sinspire game.
Gods know we can't even see the bonds magi lurking, and we've suddenly got assassins coming out of our assholes. Know something? I'd lay even odds that between the people following us and the people hunting us, we've become this city's principal means of employment. Tal Vahrar's entire economy is now based on fucking with us.
It was a short walk, if a nervous one, to the crossroads just north of the gilded cloister. Cargo wagons clattered across the cobbles and tradesfolk walked placidly to their jobs. As far as they knew, Locke thought, the Savrola was the quietest, best-guarded neighbourhood in the city, a place where nothing worse than the occasional drunk foreigner ever disturbed the calm. Locke and Jean turned left at the intersection, then approached the door of the first disused shop on their right. While Jean kept a watch on the street behind them, Locke stepped up to the door and rapped sharply three times. It opened immediately, and a stout young man in a brown leather coat beckoned them in.
"Stay away from the window," he said, once he'd closed and bolted the door behind them.
The window was covered with tightly drawn sailcloth curtains, but Locke agreed that there was no need to tempt fate. The only light in the room came from the sunrise, filtered soft pink through the curtains, enabling Locke to see two pairs of men waiting at the rear of the shop. Each pair consisted of one heavy, broad-shouldered man and one smaller man, and all four of the strangers were wearing identical grey cloaks and broad-brimmed grey hats.
"Get dressed,"
said the man in the leather coat, pointing to a pile of clothing on a small table. Locke and Jean were soon outfitted in their own matching grey cloaks and hats.
"New summer fashion for Tal Vahrar?" said Locke.
"A little game for anyone trying to follow you," said the man.
He snapped his fingers, and one set of grey-clad strangers moved to stand right behind the door.
"I'll go out first. You stand behind these two, follow them out, then enter the third carriage. Understood?"
"What carriage?"
Locke started to say, but he cut himself off as he heard the clatter of hooves and wheels in the street immediately outside. Shadows passed before the window, and after a few seconds the man in the brown coat unbolted the door.
"Third carriage, move fast," he said without turning around, and then he threw the door open and was out into the street.
At the curb just outside the disused shop, three identical carriages were lined up. Each was black lacquered wood with no identifying crests or banners. Each had heavy drapes drawn over its windows, and each was pulled by two black horses. Even their drivers all looked vaguely similar, and wore the same reddish uniforms under leather overcoats. The first pair of grey strangers stepped out the door and hurried to the first carriage in line. Locke and Jean left the disused shop a second later, hurrying to the rear carriage. Locke caught a glimpse of the last team of grey strangers all but running to the door of the middle carriage behind them. Jean worked the latch on the rear carriage's door, held it open for Locke, and flung himself inside afterward.
"Welcome aboard, gentlemen."
Meraine lounged in the right forward corner of the compartment, her waitress clothing discarded. She was now dressed as though for a ride in an open saddle, in field boots, black breeches, a red silk shirt, and a leather vest. Locke and Jean settled beside one another in the seat across from her. Jean's slamming of the door threw them into semi-darkness, and the carriage lurched into motion.
"Where the hell are we going?"
Locke began to shrug off his grey cloak as he spoke.
"Leave that on, Master Costa. You'll need it when we get out again. First we'll all tour the Savrola for a bit, then we'll split, one carriage to the Golden Steps, one to the northern edge of the Great Gallery, and us to the docks to catch a boat."
"A boat to where?"
"Don't be impatient. Sit back and enjoy the ride."
That was difficult, to say the least, in the hot and stuffy compartment. Locke felt sweat running down his brow, and he grumpily removed his hat and held it in his lap. He and Jean attempted to pelt Meraine with questions, but she answered with nothing but noncommittal hmms until they gave up. Tedious minutes passed. Locke felt the carriage rattling around several corners, then down a series of inclines that had to be the ramp from the upper heights of the Savrola to the sea-level docks.
"We're almost there,"
said Merrain, after another few minutes had passed in uncomfortable, jouncing silence.
"Hats back on. When the carriage stops, go straight to the boat. Take your seat at the rear, and for the gods' sake, if you see anything dangerous, duck."
True to her word, the carriage rattled to a halt just a few heartbeats later. Locke planted his hat over his hair once again, fumbled for the door mechanism, and squinted as it opened into bright morning light.
"Out," said Merrain. "Don't waste time."
They were down on the interior docks at the very northeastern tip of the Savrola, with a sheer wall of black elderglass behind them and several dozen anchored ships on the gleaming, choppy water before them. One boat was lashed to the nearest pier, a sleek gig about 40 feet long, with a raised and enclosed gallery at the stern. Two lines of rowers, 5 to a side, filled most of the rest of its space. Locke hopped down from the carriage and led the way toward the boat, past a pair of alert men wearing cloaks as heavy as his own, quite inappropriate for the weather. They were standing at near attention, not lounging, and Locke caught a glimpse of a sword hilt barely hidden beneath one cloak. He all but scampered up the flimsy ramp to the boat, hopped down into it, and threw himself onto the bench at the rear of the passenger gallery. The gallery, fortunately, was only enclosed on 3 sides. A decent forward view of their next little voyage would be vastly preferable to another trip inside a dark box. Jean was close behind him, but Merrain turned right, climbed through the mass of rowers, and seated herself in the coxswain's position at the bow. The soldiers on the dock rapidly pulled back the ramp, unlashed the boat, and gave it a good push away from the dock with their legs.
"Pull!"
said Merrain, and the rowers exploded into action. Soon the boat was creaking to their steady rhythm and knifing across the little waves of Talvaraz harbour. Locke took the opportunity to study the men and women at the oars. They were all leanly muscled, all with hair neatly trimmed short, most with fairly visible scars. Not one of them looked to be younger than their mid-30s. Veteran soldiers, then. Possibly even eyes without their masks and cloaks.
"I have to say Stragos people put on a good production," said Jean.
He then raised his voice.
"Hey, Merrain! Can we take these ridiculous clothes off?"
She turned only long enough to nod, and then returned her attention to the waters of the harbour. Locke and Jean eagerly removed their hats and cloaks and piled the clothing on the deck at their feet. The ride across the water took about 1/3 of an hour, as near as Locke could tell. He would have preferred to be free to study the harbour in all directions, but what he could see out the open front of the gallery revealed enough. First they headed southwest, following the curve of the inner docks, past the great gallery and the golden steps. Then they turned south, putting the open sea on their right, and sped toward a huge crescent island of a like size with the one on which the Sinspire sat. Talvaraz's southwestern crescent wasn't tiered. It was more like a naturally irregular hillside, studded with a number of stone towers and battlements. The huge stone quays and long wooden docks at its northwestern tip comprised the Silver Marina, where commercial vessels could put in for repairs or refitting. But past that, past the bobbing shapes of old galleons waiting for new masts or sails, lay a series of tall grey walls that formed enclosed bays. The top of these walls supported round towers, where the dark shapes of catapults and patrolling soldiers could be seen. The bow of their boat was soon pointed at the nearest of these huge stone enclosures.
"I'll be damned," said Jean. "I think they're taking us into the Sword Marina."
2. The vast stone walls of the artificial bay were gated with wood. As the boat approached, shouts rang out from the battlements above, and the clanking of heavy chains echoed off stone and water. A crack appeared in the middle of the gate, and then the 2 doors slowly swung inward, sweeping a small wave before them. As the boat passed through the gate, Locke tried to estimate the size of everything he was seeing. The opening itself had to be 70 or 80 feet wide, and the timbers of the doors looked to be as thick as an average man's torso.
Meraine called instructions to the rowers, and they brought the boat in carefully, coasting gently up to a small wooden dock where a single man waited to receive them. The rowers had placed the boat at an angle, so that the end of the dock barely scraped the hull of the boat between the rowers and the passenger gallery.
"Your stop, gentlemen," called Meraine. "No time to tie up, I'm afraid. Be nimble or get wet."
"You're the soul of kindness, madam," said Locke. "I've shed any lingering regret about failing to leave a tip for you."
He moved out of the gallery and to the gunwale on his right hand. There the stranger waited with one arm held out to assist him. Locke sprang up to the dock easily enough with the man's help, and the two of them in turn yanked Jean to safety. Meraine's rowers backed water immediately. Locke watched as the gig made sternway, aligned itself with the gate, and then sped back out of the little bay at high speed. Chains rattled once again, and water surged as the gates drew closed. Locke glanced up and saw that teams of men were turning huge capstans, one on either side of the bay doors.
"Welcome," said the man who'd helped them out of the boat. "Welcome to the most foolish damn venture I ever heard of, much less got pressed into. Can't imagine whose wife you must have fucked to get assigned to this here suicide mission, sirs."
The man could have been anywhere between 50 and 60. He had a chest like a tree stump and a belly that hung over his belt as though he were trying to smuggle a sack of grain beneath his tunic. Yet his arms and neck were almost scrawny in their wiriness, seamed with jutting veins and the scars of hard living. He had a round face, a woolly white beard, and a greasy streak of white hair that fell straight off the back of his head like a waterfall. His dark eyes were nestled in pockets of wrinkles under permanent furrows.
"That might have been a pleasant diversion," said Jean, "if we'd known we were going to end up here anyway. Who might you be?"
"Name's Caldris," said the old man. "Ship's master without a ship. You two must be masters de Ferra and Costa."
"Must be," said Locke.
"Let me show you around," said Caldris. "Ain't much to see now, but you'll be seeing a lot of it."
He led the way up a set of rickety stairs at the rear of the dock, which opened onto a stone plaza that rose 4 or 5 feet above the water. The entire artificial bay, Locke saw, was a square roughly 100 yards on a side. Walls enclosed it on three sides, and at the rear rose the steep glass hillside of the island. There were a number of structures built on platforms sticking out from that hillside, storage sheds, armories, and the like, he presumed. The gleaming expanse of water beside the plaza, now sealed off from the harbour once again by the wooden gates, was large enough to float several ships of war, and Locke was surprised to see that there was only one craft tied up. A one-masted dinghy, barely 14 feet long, rocked gently at the plaza's side.
"Quite a bay for such a small boat," he said.
"Eh? Well, the ignorant need room in which to risk their lives without bothering anybody else for a while," said Caldris. "This here's our own private pissing pond. Never you mind the soldiers on the walls, they'll ignore us, unless we drown. Then they'll probably laugh."
"Just what is it," said Locke, "that you think we're doing here, Caldris?"
"I've got a month or so in which to turn two ignorant, straight-legged, fumble-thumb landlubbers into something resembling phony sea officers. All gods as my witness, sirs, I suspect this is all going to end in screaming and drowning."
"I might have taken offence at that if I didn't know that every word you just called us was true," said Locke. "We told Stragos we didn't know the first damn thing about sailing."
"The Protector seems mighty set on having you out to sea regardless."
"How long have you been in his navy?" asked Jean.
"Been at sea 45 years, maybe. In the Varari navy, even before there was Archons. Been in the Thousand Day War, the old wars against Jerem, the war against the Ghost Winds Armada. Seen a lot of shit, gentlemen. Thought I had it sewn up,
Been master on Archon's vessels for 20 years. Good pay. Even got a house coming, or so I thought. Before this shit. No offence.
None taken, said Locke. This some sort of punishment detail?
Oh, it's punishment, Costa. It's punishment, all right. Just weren't no crime done to earn it. Archon sort of volunteered me. Fuck me, but that's what all my loyalty bought. That and a taste of the Archon's wine, so I can't just quit or run away on you. Poisoned wine. The waiting sort of poison. I take you to sea, outlive all this nonsense, I get the antidote. Maybe my house, if I'm lucky.
The Archon gave you poisoned wine, said Locke.
Didn't know it was poisoned, obviously. What was I supposed to do? Caldris spat. Not fucking drink it?
Of course not, said Locke. We're passengers in the same boat, friend. Except it was cider with us. We had a hell of a thirst.
Oh, really?
Caldris gaped.
Ha! Fuck me raw! Here I thought I was the biggest damn fool on the Sea of Brass. Here I thought I was the damnedest halfwit of a blind, useless, old... Ah!
He seemed to notice the glare Locke and Jean were giving him in unison, and he coughed loudly.
Which is to say, sirs, that misery loves company. And I can see that we're all going to be real enthusiastic about this here do-or-die mission.
Right. So, tell us, said Jean, exactly how are we going to get on with this?
Well, first I reckon we talk. Second, I reckon we sail. I got just a few things to say before we tempt the gods, so open your ears. First, it takes 5 years or so to make a landsman into a halfway decent sailor. 10 to 15 to make a halfway decent sea officer. So fucking attend this. I ain't making no halfway decent sea officers of you. I'm making shams. I'm making it so you're not embarrassed to talk rope and canvas around real sailors. And that's about it. Maybe... Just maybe that's what I can do to you in a month. So you can pretend to give orders while taking them from me. Taking them good.
Fair enough, said Locke. The more you handle, the more comfortable we are. Honest.
I just don't want you to decide you're heroes who've learned the full business, so's you start changing sails and trim and courses without my leave. Do that, and we're all gonna die, fast as a one-copper fuck in a one-whore cat-house. I hope that's clear.
Not to get ahead of ourselves, said Jean, but where the hell is this ship on which we would never, ever dare do anything like that?
It's around, said Caldris, getting a bit of finishing in another bay, just to help it hold together. For the time being, that there's the only vessel you're fit to board.
He pointed at the dinghy.
That's what I'll learn you on.
What does that little thing have to do with a real ship?
That little thing is what I learned on, Costa. That little thing is where any real sea officer starts. That's how you can cop to the basics. Hull, wind, and water. Know I'm on a boat, and you can think it out on a ship. So, off with your coats and vests and fancy shit. Leave anything you mind getting wet, as I'm making no promises. Boots as well. You'll do this barefoot.
Once Locke and Jean had stripped down to their tunics and breeches, Caldris led them over to a large covered basket that sat on the stones near the docked dinghy. He undid the cover, reached in, and removed a live kitten.
Hello, you monstrous little necessity.
Meow,
said the monstrous little necessity.
Cough!
Costa!
Caldris shoved the squirming kitten into Locke's arms. Look after her for a few minutes.
Why do you keep a kitten in that basket?
The kitten, dissatisfied with Locke's arms, decided to wrap her paws around his neck and experiment on it with her claws.
When you go to sea, there's two necessities for luck. First, you're courting an awful fate if you take a ship to sea without at least one woman officer. It's the law of the Lord of the Grasping Waters. His mandate. He's got a fixation for the daughters of the land. He'll smash any ship that puts to sea without at least one aboard. Plus, it's plain common sense. They're good officers. Decent plain sailors, but finer officers than you or I. Just the way the gods made 'em. Second, it's powerful bad luck to put out without cats on board. Not only as they kill the rats, but as they're the proudest creatures anywhere, wet or dry. Yono admires the little fuckers. Got a ship with women and cats aboard, you'll have the finest luck you can hope for. Now, our little boat's so small I reckon we're fine without no woman. Fishers and harbour boats go out all the time, no worries. But with the pair of you aboard, I'll be damned if I'm not bringing a cat. A little one suits a little vessel.
So, we have to tend this kitten while we're out there risking our lives?
I'll throw you overboard before I lose her, Costa.
Caldris chuckled.
You think I'm lying. You just test me. But keep your britches on. She'll be in the covered basket.
Speaking of the basket seemed to recall it to his mind. He reached into it again and drew out a small loaf of bread and a silver knife. Locke saw that the loaf had many small marks upon it, about the size of the muzzle of the little creature trying to slip out of his arms. Caldris didn't seem to care.
Master de Ferra, hold out your right hand and don't whine.
Jean extended his right hand toward Caldris. Without hesitation, the sailing master slashed the knife across Jean's palm. The big man said nothing, and Caldris grunted as though pleasantly surprised. He turned Jean's palm upside down and smeared the bread with the blood trickling from the cut.
Now you, Master Costa, keep that kitten still. Vile luck to cut her by accident. Plus she's armed, fore and aft.
A moment later, Caldris had made a shallow, stinging cut across Locke's right palm and was pressing the loaf of bread up against it as though to stanch the wound. When he seemed to decide that Locke had bled sufficiently, he smiled and moved to the edge of the stone plaza, overlooking the water.
"I know you both been passengers on ships," he said, "but passengers don't signify. Passengers ain't involved. Now you're gonna be involved proper, so I got to make things right for us first."
He cleared his throat, knelt at the edge of the water, and put up his arms. In one hand he held the loaf of bread, in the other the silver knife.
Yono, Stormbringer, Lord of the Grasping Waters, your servant Caldris Balcoma calls. Long you been pleased to show your servant mercy, and your servant kneels to show his devotion. Surely you know a mighty fucking mess waits over the horizon for him.
He tossed the bloody knife into the bay and said,
"This is the blood of landsmen. All blood is water. All blood is yours. This is a knife of silver, metal of the sky, sky that touches water. Your servant gives you blood and silver to show his devotion."
He took the loaf of bread in both hands, tore it in half, and threw both halves into the water.
"This is the bread of landsmen, that landsmen need to live. At sea, all life is yours. At sea, yours is the only mercy. Give your servant strong winds and open waters, Lord.
Show him mercy in his passage. Show him the might of your will within the waves, and send him safe home again. Hail, Iono, lord of the grasping waters!
Caldrus rose from his knees, groaning, and wiped a few smears of blood on his tunic.
Right! If that can't help, we never had a fucking chance.
Beg pardon, said Jean, but it seems to me you could have possibly mentioned us along with yourself.
Don't think nothing of it, De Ferre. I prosper, you prosper. I cop it, you're screwed. Praying for my health works to your full advantage. Now, put the cat in the basket, Costa, and let's do some business.
A few minutes later, Caldrus had Locke and Jean seated beside one another at the rear of the dinghy, which was still lashed firmly to several iron rings set into the stone of the plaza. The covered basket was sitting on the tiny deck of the dinghy at Locke's feet, occasionally emitting bumping and scratching noises.
Right, said Caldrus. Far as the basics go, a boat is just a little ship, and a ship is just a bigger boat. Hull goes in the water, mast points toward the sky.
Of course, said Locke, as Jean nodded vigorously.
The nose of your boat is called the bow. The ass is called the stern. Ain't no right and left at sea. Right is starboard, left is larboard. Say right or left, and you're liable to get whipped. And remember, when you're directing someone else, it's the ship's starboard and larboard you're talking about, not your own.
Look, little as we know, Caldrus, I dare say we know that much, said Locke.
Well, far be it from me to correct the young master, said Caldrus. But as this venture is somewhat in the way of completely fucking mad, and since all our lives are looking mighty cheap, I'm going to start by presuming that you don't know water from weasel piss. Is that suitable by you, gentlemen?
Locke opened his mouth to say something ill-advised, but Caldrus went on.
Now, unrack the oars. Slide 'em in the oarlocks. Costa, your starboard oar. De Ferre, your larboard.
Caldrus unlashed the dinghy from the iron rings, threw the ropes into the bottom of the boat, and hopped down into it, landing just before the mast. He settled down onto his backside and grinned as the boat swayed.
I've locked the rudder tight for now. You two will do all our steering. God's help us. De Ferre, push us off from the quay. That's right. Nice and easy. Can't fly sails straight from the dockside. Got to get some sea room first. Plus there's no breeze behind these walls for us to use anyway. Row gently. Pay attention as I move around. Look how I'm making us wobble. Don't like that, do you? You're turning green, Costa.
Hardly, muttered Locke.
This is important. What I'm trying to tell you about now is called trim. Weight needs to be distributed sensible in a boat or a ship. I move to starboard, we heel over on Costa's side. I move to larboard, we heel over even worse on De Ferre's side. Can't have that. That's why stowing cargo proper is so important on a ship. Gotta have balance fore and aft, starboard and larboard. Can't have the bow in the air or the stern higher than the mast. Look silly, then you sink and die. That's basically what I mean when I says trim. Now, time to learn how to row.
We already know how to...
I don't care what you think you know, Costa. Until further notice, we're gonna presume that you're too dumb to count to one.
Locke would later swear that they must have spent 2 or 3 hours rowing around in circles on that artificial bay, with Caldrus crying out,
Harder larboard! Backwater! Harder starboard!
and a dozen other commands, seemingly at random. The sailing master constantly shifted his weight, left and right, forward and centre, to force them to fight for stability. To make things even more interesting, there was an obvious difference between the power of Jean's strokes and the power of Locke's, and they had to concentrate to avoid constantly turning to starboard. They were at it so long that Locke started in surprise when Caldris finally called for a halt to their labour.
"Vast ruin, you fucking toddlers!"
Caldris stretched and yawned. The sun was approaching the centre of the sky. Locke's arms felt wrung out. His tunic was soaked through with sweat, and he fervently wished that he'd had less coffee and more actual food for breakfast.
"Better than you was 2 hours ago, I'll give you that. That and not much else. You got to know your starboard and larboard, fore and aft, boats and oars, like you know the width of your own cocks. Ain't no such thing as a calm or convenient emergency out on the blue."
The sailing master produced lunch from a leather sack at the bow of the dinghy, and they floated relaxingly in the middle of the enclosed square bay while they ate. The men shared black bread and hard cheese, while the kitten was let out to make quick work of a pat of butter in a stone crock. The skin that Caldris passed around was full of pink water, warm rainwater mixed with just enough cheap red wine to partly conceal its stale, leathery taste. Caldris took only a few sips, but the two thieves rapidly finished it off.
"So, our ship is waiting for us somewhere around here," said Locke, when his thirst was temporarily beaten down.
"But where are we going to get a crew?"
"A fine question, Costa. I wish I knew the answer. The Archon said the matter is being attended to, that's all."
"I suspected you'd say something like that."
"No sense in dwelling on what's beyond our power at the moment," said Caldris.
The sailing master lifted the kitten, who was still licking her greasy nose and paws, and stuck her back into the basket with surprising tenderness.
"So, you've done some rowing. I'll get those men up top to open the gate, take the rudder, and we're going to head out and see if we can catch enough breeze to hoist some canvas. You two have any money in the things you left ashore?"
"Some," said Locke. "Maybe 20 volani. Why?"
"Then I'll bet you 20 volani that you two are going to capsize us at least once before the sun goes down."
"I thought you were here to teach us how to do things the right way."
"I am, and I damn well will. It's just that I know first-time sailors too well. Make the bet, and the money's as good as mine. Hell, I'll pay up a full salary against your 20 silvers if I'm wrong."
"I'm in," said Locke. "Jerome?"
"We've got the kitten and a blood blessing on our side," said Jean. "Underestimate us at your peril, sailing master."
3. It had been refreshing, at first, to work for a while in completely soaked tunic and breeches, after they'd righted the dinghy and rescued the kitten, of course. But now the sun was lowering in the west, casting a golden halo around the dark outlines of the battlements and towers above the Sword Marina, and the gentle harbour breeze had begun to chill Locke despite the lingering heat of the summer air. He and Jean were rowing the dinghy toward the open gate to their private bay. Caldris had been happy to earn his 20 volani, but not happy enough that he was willing to trust them with the sails again.
"Vast rowing,"
said Caldris as they finally drifted near the edge of the stone plaza. Caldris tended to the business of tying them up again while Locke stowed his oar and breathed a deep sigh of relief. Every muscle in his back seemed to slide painfully against those surrounding it, as though someone had thrown grit in between them. He had a headache from the glare of sun on water, and his old wound in his left shoulder was demanding attention above and beyond his other aches. Locke and Jean clambered stiffly out of the boat and stretched, while Caldris, clearly amused, uncovered the basket and plucked the bedraggled kitten out of it.
"There, there," he said,
allowing it to nestle within his crossed arms.
"The young masters didn't mean anything by that soaking they gave you. They got it just as bad."
"Row,"
it said.
"I fancy that means fuck you," said Caldris. "But at least we've got our lives. So what do you think, sirs? An educational day?"
"I hope we've shown some aptitude, at least," groaned Locke, kneading a knot in the small of his back.
"Baby steps, Custer. As far as sailors go, you haven't even learned to suck milk from a tit yet. But now you know starboard from larboard, and I'm 20 Valani richer."
"Indeed," sighed Locke as he fetched his coat, vest, neckcloths, and shoes from the ground. He tossed a small leather purse to the sailing master, who dangled it at the kitten and cooed as though to a small child. Locke happened to glance over at the gate while he was throwing his coat on over his damp tunic, and he saw Meraine's gig slip into the artificial bay. She was seated at the bow again, looking as though they had parted 10 minutes rather than 10 hours before.
"Your ride back to civilization, gents!"
Caldris raised Locke's coin purse in a salute.
"See you bright and early tomorrow. Only gets worse from here, so mind yourselves. Enjoy those nice beds while they're still available."
Meraine was completely unwilling to answer questions as the team of 10 soldiers rowed them back to the docks beneath the Savrola, which suited Locke's mood. He and Jean commiserated over their aches and pains while lounging, as best the space allowed, in the rear gallery.
"I could sleep for about 3 days, I think," said Locke.
"Let's order a big dinner when we get back, and some baths to take the knots out. After that, I'll race you to unconsciousness."
"Can't," Locke sighed. "Can't. I have to go see Requin tonight."
"By now he probably knows Stragos pulled us in again a few nights ago. I need to talk to him before he gets annoyed, and I need to give him the chairs. And I need to somehow tell him about all of this and convince him not to strangle us with our own intestines if we leave for a few months."
"Gods," said Jean, "I've been trying not to think about that. You just barely convinced him that we've been assigned to the Sinspire to go after his vault. What can you say that will make this whole out-to-sea thing plausible?"
"I have no idea."
Locke massaged the aching vicinity of his old shoulder wound. "Hopefully the chairs will put him in a forgiving mood. If not, you'll get the bill for cleaning my brains off his plaza stones." When the rowers finally pulled the boat up alongside the Savrola docks, where a carriage was waiting with several guards, Meraine left the bow and made her way back to where Locke and Jean were sitting.
7th hour of the morning tomorrow," she said. "I'll have a carriage at the Villa Candessa. We'll vary your movement for a few mornings for safety's sake. Stay at your inn this evening."
"Out of the question," said Locke. "I have business on the Golden Steps tonight."
"Cancel it."
"Go to hell! How do you propose to stop me?"
"You might be surprised."
Meraine rubbed her temples as though she felt a headache coming on, then sighed.
"You're sure you can't cancel it?"
"If I cancel my business tonight, you know who at the Sinspire is likely to cancel us," said Locke.
"If you're worried about Requin," she said, "I could simply arrange for quarters to be found in the Sword Marina. He'd never be able to reach you there. You'd be safe until your training was finished."
"Jerome and I have sunk 2 years in this bloody city into our plans for Requin," said Locke. "We intend to finish them. Tonight is critical."
"On your head be it, then. I can send a carriage with some of my men. Can it wait 2 hours?"
"If that's what it takes, fine." Locke smiled. "In fact, send 2. One for me, one for cargo."
"Don't push your..."
"Excuse me," said Locke, "but is the money coming out of your pocket? You want to protect me, surround me with your agents. Fine, I accept. Just send 2 carriages. I'll be on my best behavior.
So be it, she said. 2 hours, no sooner.
4. The western horizon had swallowed the sun, and the 2 moons visible in the cloudless sky were soft red, like silver coins dipped in wine. The driver of the carriage rapped 3 times on the roof to announce their arrival at the Sinspire, and Locke moved the window curtain back over the corner he'd been peeking out of. It had taken time for the pair of carriages to thread their way out of the Savrola, across the great gallery and through the bustling traffic of the Golden Steps. Locke had found himself alternately stifling yawns and cursing the bumpy ride. His companion, a slender swordswoman with a well-used rapier resting across her legs, had steadfastly ignored him from her position on the opposite seat. Now, as the carriage jostled to a halt, she preceded him out the door, tucking her weapon under a long blue coat that hung to her calves. After she'd scanned the warm night for trouble, she beckoned wordlessly for Locke to follow. As per Locke's instructions, the carriage driver had turned onto the cobbled drive that led to a courtyard behind the Sinspire. Here, a pair of converted stone houses held the tower's primary kitchens and food storage areas. By the light of red and gold lanterns bobbing on unseen lines, Sinspire attendants were coming and going in squads, carrying forth elaborate meals and returning with empty platters. The smell of richly seasoned meat filled the air. Locke's bodyguard continued to look around, as did the 2 soldiers atop the carriage, each dressed in nondescript coachman's uniforms. The 2nd carriage, the one carrying Locke's suite of chairs, rattled to a halt behind the 1st. Its team of grey horses stamped their feet and snorted, as though the scent of the kitchens was not to their taste. A heavy-set Sinspire attendant